From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For much the greater part of his public life, Ralph Nader was a tireless civic watchdog, the quintessential consumer advocate dogging corporate America. But his run in the 2000 presidential election caused a different kind of controversy. 2.8 million Americans rejoiced and gave him their votes. Rock-ribbed Democrats charged he lost Al Gore the White House. Nader charged then and now that the two main parties had become as interchangeable as Coke and Pepsi. The run for president, he said, was the last resort forced by a Democratic Party indifferent to the needs of its constituency. To many Democrats, Nader and his Green Party hosts are an assault on an unguarded flank that serves only the Republicans. Now, again, there is talk of a Nader run at the White House in 2004, and as always, Mr. Nader has his own agenda. Tonight on Point, Ralph Nader on The Nation, The World, and The Ballot Box. Would you welcome another Ralph Nader candidacy? What have the George W. Bush years told you about the Coke and Pepsi claim? Is Ralph Nader, third-party threat, necessary medicine for the American political system, or just poison for the Democrats? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is consumer advocate, public citizen, and controversial political Ralph Nader. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Nader.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Also joining me in the studio tonight is On Point's news analyst Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University. His latest book is Interracial Intimacy, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. Good to have you here, Randall Kennedy.
Thanks so much.
Ralph Nader, let's put the big question on the table right away. Are you running for president in 2004?
As I said last week, I'm considering, but I won't make my decision until the end of this year.
And how will you make that decision?
It'll depend on a number of factors. Right after Labor Day, I'm going to submit to the Republican and Democratic parties a series of issues and positions and subject matter and get their response. For example, issues like what is their position on a living wage in this country? What is their position on a major effort to crack down on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse and initiate prevention measures? What is their issue on labor law reform, so tens of millions of workers can have a chance to engage in collective bargaining and form unions, like in Walmart and McDonald's. Universal health care with an emphasis on cost control from the waste and corruption that now occurs, and prevention of trauma and disease. And we'll see what they respond. The important thing is to get a response from the parties who really will control the tempo of the campaigns, not just the candidates.
So you think that the party hierarchy is going to be more influential than the individual candidates? I mean, doesn't it really boil down ultimately to who's running? You've said that you're weighing how well Howard Dean and Representative Kucinich are doing as a measure of whether or not you'll jump in the race. Is that right?
Yeah, because, you see, they are both, in a way, outsider candidates representing not conventional, certainly Kucinich, not conventional Democratic Leadership Council philosophy that dominates the corporate Democrats. And so if they try to, the corporate Democrats that run the party, if they try to marginalize Dean and Kucinich the way they promised to do after somehow George McGovern got the nomination in 1972 and they changed the rules of the Democratic Party, that's another factor of what I call the two-party duopoly that shuts out competition, even competition inside its own ranks.
So if Dennis Kucinich is not making such a persuasive showing already, Howard Dean is doing rather well. If Howard Dean is swimming along, doing well, you've said you'll make a decision this year. If he's doing well and appears to be headed toward strong contention for the party's nomination, will that be enough for Ralph Nader to sit back, or are you going to hold the threat out right into next year?
First of all, the important thing is where Dean stands on other issues than he's been talking about. He has been rather quiet on the cardinal issue in our political economy, which is the surrender of popular sovereignty to corporate power. Our corporate government, corporatization of universities, corporatization of the media, conglomeratization and commercialization of almost everything that matters in this country now, including commercializing childhood through corporate entertainment and other products. So He hasn't spoken out on that. He hasn't spoken out on what he's going to do on the criminal justice system, or shall we call it the criminal injustice system. He hasn't spoken out on the civil justice system, that is access to courts by wrongfully injured people. And he refuses to cut the swollen, bloated military budget that keeps growing like Topsy, full of massive weapon systems in the pipeline designed for a Soviet Union era of hostility, for one example of waste. So
Ralph Nader,
he's got a long way to go.
We want to turn to a lot of these issues tonight, but I just want to get as much clarity as we can. You seem to be, in this conversation, leaving yourself a lot of latitude about when, whether, if you will announce a candidacy. There's no clear end point as you describe it here. There's no clear milestones you're setting for Howard Dean. And so does that mean you might jump in even into next year sometime?
Well, it's not an SAT score. I mean, there's a qualitative dimension to these politicians and whether the parties will allow them in. I mean, Dean is an insurgent. He certainly viewed that way from Washington. Kucinich is in Washington, but he's viewed as an insurgent because he represents many of the policies of the old Democratic Party back 20, 30, 40 years ago. But, you know, if both parties continue to sell our elections, our candidacies, and our government to the highest corporate and business bidders, corruption of campaigns, for example, with business money, then they both deserve to be condemned. We're going to see whether the Democrats are going to try to steer a different route where they go for votes rather than for money.
So that sounds to me like an open possibility of you, Ralph Nader, jumping in again into the campaign next year. You clearly, from the ballot results, have millions of supporters. You also, clearly, from all the post-game analysis after the 2000 elections, have a lot of people who saw you as a spoiler. If you run again for the presidency, Ralph Nader, what, if anything, would you do differently from last time in your approach to the campaign, to how your candidacy figures in?
Well, last time was basically a 4 or 5 month campaign. If I run again, it will be an earlier campaign, but it will be on multiple objectives. For example, there are some Democrats on the Hill, to the surprise of some people listening to this program, who want a progressive third-party candidate to run in order to generate a spillover votes to support progressive Democrats running for the Senate and the House. Senator Maria Cantwell won by 2,300 votes from the state of Washington in the year 2000, and I got 110,000 votes, and there was no Green Party Senate candidate. The spillover clearly spelled the difference, if you want to play a what-if game.
Mm-hmm.
Sent her to the Senate, made it 50-50, Republican-Democrat, set the stage for Vermont Senator Jeffords to become an independent and throw the Senate into Democratic hands. So there's an issue here when you have 100 million people eligible to vote but who do not vote, sometimes for very good reasons. You have to have energetic, multiple-party candidates who can bring out that vote. And sometimes it will redound to the benefit of progressive candidates and another party.
So spillover effects, we understand that. Of course, many have alleged that the spillover effect of your last candidacy was to cost Al Gore the election. Do you think you could cost the Democrats the election again in 2004?
Well, that's certainly up to them. We don't have a patent on these issues. If they come out strongly for 47 million American workers who work full-time today and do not earn a living wage, that is, they earn minimum wage or $6, $7, $8, $9 an hour, they can take that issue away. The other thing is really important to know is that there are political observers of some sophistication who think that in year 2000, the Nader-LaDuke ticket pushed the Gore campaign against the wishes of Lieberman into a more progressive rhetoric when he said, "I'll fight for the people, not for the powerful." And Gore, in his convention address in Los Angeles, said he'd go out after the insurance and oil and drug companies.
Do you think that helped him?
The argument is that he actually was pushed into the progressive arena a little more and got more votes than I cost him. Remember, the exit polls show that of all the votes the Nader-LaDuke ticket got, 25% said they would have voted for Bush, 42% said they would have voted for Gore, and the rest said they wouldn't have voted at all. They would have stayed home. So let's be more specific, more multidimensional here than the usual end game analysis.
absolutely happy to be and ready to be and have an hour to be. But top line, you're rejecting the spoiler label.
By the way, 12 times more Democrats in Florida voted for George Bush than voted for me. I don't see the Democrats beating up on him. 35% of all union workers voted for Bush. I don't see the Democrats going after the AFL-CIO and misspending all that money on television instead of educating workers about where their interests lie from their point of view.
Ralph Nader, your core critique, as you've articulated quite colorfully sometimes, in October of 2000, you said the only difference between the Republican and Democratic parties is the velocities with which their knees hit the floor when corporations knock on their door. After 2.5, going on 3 years of George W. Bush and 3 big tax cuts and a couple of wars, do you still feel that way? No difference.
That statement was focused on corporate policy. And as far as corporate policy goes, the two parties are very convergent, even though there are differences, obviously, between a Senator Kennedy and a Tom DeLay.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the main thrust of the two parties. And when they were in charge under Clinton Gore, the regulatory agencies were as bad, if not worse, with one exception, EPA, than under Reagan Bush. That may be hard to believe by someone who doesn't participate in the very difficult effort of trying to petition these regulatory agencies like OSHA and the Auto Safety Agency and the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
But every 4 years, these agencies go under more and more of the power of the corporate lobbyists and the corporate executives who become heads of these agencies or departments, regardless of whether there's a Democrat or Republican in the White House. So the question is, are there differences between the two parties? Sure. Are there differences enough? No. Are the similarities towering over the dwindling real differences that the Democrats are willing to fight over in contrast to their good rhetoric? Yes.
And you'll say that even after 9/11 and the war in Iraq and the tax cuts, you're still saying these parties are fundamentally ditto parties.
Well, for example, the Democrats opposed Bush's two gigantic tax cuts for the wealthy, but they didn't stop them in the Congress when they could have. Their control of the Senate in June 2001 could have stopped the $1.3 trillion tax cut, which they spoke against, and they didn't. I mean, time and time again, they gave them the war resolution. Time and time again, they say the right things, but they go along with the Republicans. They don't have fight in them as a party. Why? Because on their off hours, they're dialing for the same kind of business dollars that the Republicans are dialing for.
Randall Kennedy, Ralph Nader says only way to do this is to stand up and take them straight on. The Democrats still aren't doing it vigorously enough. What do you say?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who share Mr. Nader's goals. There are a lot of people who are impatient along with him with the two-party dictatorship. But there are also a lot of those same people who wonder about Mr. Nader's politics. They see the goals, they see his rhetoric, but they don't see a clear way in which he's going to push things forward. There are a number of people who would agree with Ralph Nader about a lot of things, but who nonetheless think that his interventions into presidential politics have been counterproductive. I mean, after all, you could ask the question, are we closer to Ralph Nader's politics today than before his intervention in 2000? There are a lot of people who would say no, that against the backdrop of Ralph Nader's own standards, we are in a worse position.
Ralph Nader, we've just got a minute before the break, but there's a Reagan-esque question for you. Are we closer to Ralph Nader's positions today than we were in 2000?
Of course not. But every year that's been true for the last 20 years as corporations take over Washington in all kinds of ways. But let's make it clear. Gore won the election in 2000. He won the popular vote. Subsequent very careful impartial reviews show he won the electoral vote by winning in Florida. The election was stolen from him.
I think those are disputed in Florida now.
They may be disputed, but the best book on the subject by a New Yorker Harvard Law graduate, Jeffrey Toobin, and he's been critical of Clinton, too, after a careful review of the evidence, said that was the case. But the point is that I've never met a Democrat who's upset about the Green Party candidacy who didn't concur that Gore won the election and it was stolen. So they ought to focus on the thieves. They ought to focus on the obstacles to voting in Florida and other places around the country, often directed against minorities. In all the ways, millions of people, the estimate in 2000 was 6.5 million people, were blocked and obstructed and tricked and misled into not having their votes counted.
Ralph Nader, stand by. We're talking with Ralph Nader, consumer advocate turned controversial politico. We'll take your questions. After the break, do you want to see another Ralph Nader candidacy for U.S. president? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Ralph Nader, consumer advocate turned controversial politico, presidential candidate in the 2000 presidential campaign. He's with us tonight. You can talk to him. Did you vote for Ralph Nader in 2000? Would you do it again? Would you like to see a new Ralph Nader presidential campaign? And what do you think of the agenda that he's laying out here with us tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Great to have you.
I would like to say I didn't vote for Mr. Nader the last time around, but I would like to urge him to run this time.
Exactly why, Daniel?
I think the American electorate needs a lot of choices, and I think it's also totally absurd that anybody believes he blocked Gore from winning the election.
537 vote difference in Florida, but you don't see an impact there, Daniel?
Well, I think one of the big things that's missing from the conversation so far is about probably more than 50% of the eligible voters in the United States don't vote because they don't think they it's a meaningful vote, and I think that's true when you're talking about Democrats and Republicans in general.
So is it just you'd like to see a third-party candidate, or you want to see the kind of issues that Ralph Nader's raising tonight in the hands of a presidential candidate?
Both. And I think we really need both. I think the Republicans and the Democrats have a lot of responsibility for turning off about 50% of the electorate in the United States. I think people feel very powerless. I also feel that a lot of these people who don't vote are misleading themselves because they're giving their tacit, silent approval to what then is the result, which is annoying. But I think the Democrats and the Republicans both have a huge responsibility there, and I think it's people like Nader and other people across the political spectrum who want to give we, the American people, a lot more choices. I wish the American citizens that didn't vote last time, even if they don't like a candidate, go and vote right in a name. I don't think the press could avoid covering the situation if a lot of people showed up to the polls and didn't vote for either Democrat or Republican or anybody on the ballot.
So write them in, bring them on, and bring on Ralph Nader. We've got it.
Yes.
Daniel, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call. Tom is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tom, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I really think that it's the height of irresponsibility for Mr. Nader to say that there's absolutely no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. I think that the past 3 years of George Bush have really showed what a big difference there is when there is a Republican in the White House versus a Democrat. And I just would like him to tone down the rhetoric. I really think he cost Gore the election by splitting the vote in New Hampshire. I think he says he got 100,000 votes nationwide, and those people wouldn't have voted. But in reality, he got zero votes. He never came close to getting a single electoral vote, and that's what counts. And all he can do is be a spoiler again. I mean, he adds good issues to the debate.
Yes, he does.
Okay, but he doesn't.
The practical effect is not the one you're looking for, Tom. We've got it. Let me put both of those to you, Ralph Nader. There's a vote for and against a Nader candidacy with applause and a critique. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, I never said there's absolutely no difference. You just heard me characterize very carefully that they're not different enough and that the similarities, like on foreign policy, military policy, Federal Reserve policy, a lot of deregulatory policy, et cetera, are the same. They're converging. They're being paid to be similar by the same hundreds of millions of dollars of business contributions. The other thing is this. This country does not belong to two parties where everyone else shuts up and stays in line. Historically, in the 19th century, third parties never won a presidential election except for the Republican Party with Abraham Lincoln. Mm. But they pushed the debate. They were the first out-of-the-box third parties on the abolition of slavery, women's right to vote, trade union movement, farmer, populist, progressive. They elected senators and congressmen and governors. They pushed the debate. Our country is in serious deterioration patterns. Whether it's environmental, whether it's economic, whether it's a growth of poverty, whether it's technology that's not being properly assessed, whether it's the militarization of our government and our budgets. I mean, on and on and on. The indicators are not alerting sufficiently the so-called more enlightened Democratic Party. And the bottom line is that I don't think the Democratic Party has the capability, without being pushed, to defeat the Republicans at the congressional or presidential level.
They came awfully close last time.
Yes, but they had a perfect chance to keep the Senate. They couldn't even keep the Senate. They turned George W. Bush in October into a wartime president.
How do you factor in 9/11, though, Ralph Nader? It's more than just the Democrats here. There have been realities, circumstances, haven't there?
Yes, but you don't allow a president to plunge a nation into a war based on false pretenses. You say to that president, if President Bush does not trust the American people by giving them the truth, the American people should not trust George W. Bush with the presidency. That's the kind of elaborate rebuttal, which you can fill in with fact after fact, instead of going around saying, oh, you can't challenge Bush when he's traveling all over the country last fall beating up on Democratic senatorial candidates because he's a wartime president.
Yeah.
An unconstitutional war at that.
That didn't work too well. Justine is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Justine. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Okay. You want me to just speak?
Go for it.
Okay. I am a lifelong Democrat. I voted for Ralph Nader the last time because I felt sure that the reality was Massachusetts would probably go Democrat,
mm-hmm.
which it usually does. I am terrified of doing the same thing again because I'm so afraid that George Bush will win again.
But you're hearing Ralph Nader's critique tonight, his analysis of what's going on. He says you've got to keep waving that third-party flag anyway. You don't buy it, Justine?
No, because of what happened the last time. I agree with everything he says. I love the man. And I'm just afraid. We have to deal with reality. We have to deal with reality. I want to change the reality. I would love him to be president. But the reality is we have the Democrats and the Republicans.
And if you don't get the Democrats, you will get the Republicans, at least as it is for now. Justine, it's a great observation. Let me put it to Randall Kennedy first. Randall Kennedy, here's Justine calling in saying, hey, I'm the voice of realism here, and the reality is if you don't get one, you will get the other.
Well, I think that Justine has a point. We mentioned Lincoln before. Lincoln was not an abolitionist. In fact, a lot of abolitionists were against Lincoln. Where would we be with sort of Nader calculation with respect to Lincoln, or for that matter, FDR? I mean, again, there are a lot of people who were sympathetic to what Mr. Nader says, but in terms of pushing the country, what do you want? Do you want to try to work within the most progressive major political party we have, which is what Ralph Nader seems to want to do some of the time, or do you want to step outside of that, launch a third-party effort that is doomed to failure, and once again push the country into the arms of the Republican incumbent now?
Ralph Nader.
Well, look, the answer to this is very simple if we look at the figures. There are 100 million voters who do not vote. The Democrats have not shown an ability on their own without being pushed by an outside political effort to defeat the Republicans. They've lost governorships, including in Massachusetts, an overwhelmingly Democratic state, twice in a row. They've lost state legislatures. They've lost the Congress. Ever since Gingrich beat them, they can't get the House back. So the question is, can the Democrats do it by themselves, or do we have to broaden issues and teach them that there is a lot of people, and there are a lot of people in this country, who will gravitate to political candidates who want to push for a living wage, who want to push for a simple universal health care policy, who want to crack down on ghetto crime, who want to have a decent housing program, who want to rebuild the country, who want to cut that bloated military budget, who want to make corporations pay much more of the taxes that they've been getting away with by going to Bermuda or carving out more loopholes so the rest of the working families have to pay more.
But what about our caller Justine's reality check? She says, yes, Ralph, love you, Ralph, but you see,
here's the point. For 20 years, at an increasing rate, both Democrats and Republicans in Washington are trying to operate within a corporate-dominated government, have been shutting out the citizen groups from the Congress, shutting them out from the regulatory agencies, We cannot get anything done. We have given the Democrats 20 years begging Gore, begging Clinton, begging all these things. Issue a chemical control standard in the workplace. 8 years, OSHA, not a single chemical toxic control standard issued. Never before has that happened in the history of OSHA, just as one example. And so they don't listen. They don't listen to words. They don't listen to arguments. They don't listen to briefs. They don't listen to testimony.
Do they listen to candidacies like Ralph Nader candidacies?
The only way they're going to listen is when they think that there's another political force out there that's going to deny them votes. Mm. Then they're either going to shape up or they're going to ship out, and deservedly so.
Let's get another call. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you tonight?
Fine, thanks. Great.
Listen to Justine, Ralph. Don't do it. The thing is here, you know, Mr. Nader is completely correct in his analysis of our political situation. But what he doesn't understand is why the Democratic Party is the way it is. You know, he has to look at the individual candidates and ask himself, why are they individually so cautious and so inclined to go to a Republican-like position? And the situation is that there's no competition within the Democratic Party for each of the seats that the politicians are holding. The third party is useless. It's not going to work. What needs to happen is that you have to increase competition inside the party for every single seat.
So what's your advice to Ralph Nader, David?
My advice is to get involved with one of the parties. I mean, he's not really a politician. He's a preacher, and he's a wonderful preacher, and someday he's going to be sainted in progressive heaven.
So what party should he get involved with?
He should run as a Republican.
Reconstitute
the Teddy Rhodes. I mean, that's
why?
The opposite of preaching to the choir. Those are the people that really need to hear what he's saying and to hear his analysis of how the language of individual liberty and the ideals of our country have been distorted for the purposes of corporate power. They are the ones who need to hear this, and I believe there's a large minority of Republicans who believe their own rhetoric, who don't understand that rhetoric has been subverted,
David,
by corporate
interests. David, we've got it. You want to throw the preacher into the GOP choir. Thanks for your call. Ralph Nader, I was just reading, you sat down not long ago with Grover Norquist, who was just on this show last week, at one of his famous Wednesday meetings where all the GOP muckety-mucks get together in Washington. And it sounds to me, it reads to me, as if you tried to take that very hardcore Republican audience on just the grounds that David is raising here, asking them to question their own basic assumptions. Did the Nader preaching sell in that crowd?
In that packed room in Grover Norquist's office, I've never seen a greater collection of greed, avarice, and corporate indentured people. And I wanted to see it from the inside. The only thing Grover Norquist and I agree on is that we're against corporate welfare, against subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts, and he could do a lot more on that. But what we have to get down to is the following. I have never heard a Democrat on any talk show, after berating the Green Party campaign, ever thank Ross Perot for tossing the election in 1992 to Bill Clinton. Now, that was almost a three-way race,
and he dropped out.
He got 19 million votes.
No, it made a big difference.
Right. So why do they think that there's no chance for a three-way race? There was a three-way race in Minnesota. There's a three-way race in a number of states where independents were elected governor.
Well, they'd probably be happy to have Ross Perot back. It's Ralph Nader that the Democrats are worried about, isn't it?
What I'm saying is they all automatically say that no third party can ever win, and that's not the American way. It's like saying, well, you know, no company can ever take on Exxon or IBM or whatever. That is not the American way. Americans deserve a choice. They deserve a broader agenda. They deserve people who can get more people out to vote. They deserve competition. It's not just in the marketplace we need competition. It's in the political arena that we badly need it.
Randall Kennedy.
Well, one of the callers talked of Ralph Nader being more of a preacher than a politician. I think that the caller was onto something. We've just heard the word deserve used over and over and over again. There's a real moralism there, as if the question is what people deserve. I think that the question of policy is most important, and right behind it is how do you actually get the policies that you want pushed into the public agenda. We've heard a lot about the former. We haven't heard as much about the latter, and I think that there are a lot of people who would like to know more about that. That is the issue that I think confronts Ralph Nader and his Confederates.
Let's get another call here. Adam's calling from Norwood, Massachusetts. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, Ralph. How you doing?
Okay.
Yeah. I was just wondering, do the Democrats have a legitimate candidate who can challenge Mr. Bush? I mean, Mr. Bush, obviously, I believe his popularity has been declining. But do the Democrats have somebody who's charismatic enough and who can challenge Bush for the White House?
It's a good question, Adam. Ralph Nader?
Yeah, I think they do if they free themselves. But when you talk to a lot of these Democratic candidates, especially the ones from Congress and the Senate, they talk Senatees. They self-censor themselves. I've now met at their invitation with Gephardt, Kerry, Kucinich, and John Edwards.
Mm.
And each one of them, except for Kucinich, who is publicly what he is privately, each one of them was more progressive than they were publicly. So the answer to the question is, yeah, there are people in the Democratic Party who could give them a run, but they've got to be more courageous. Now, what will make them come out more? When other constituencies are tapped by other political forces on issues like living wage, can you imagine the Democrats hardly talk about the minimum wage, except for Ted Kennedy? The minimum wage now is 30% less than what it was in 1968 in purchasing power. It should be about $8 an hour now. It's $5.15.
So what do you think about the Howard Dean candidacy then, Ralph Nader?
I don't think he's got it yet. He's not broad enough on the issues the way the congressional candidates are, because they're just more accustomed to talking about more issues.
In other words, he rode the anti-war theme for a while. That brought him up, but you don't see him covering the rest of the waterfront?
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, it's extremely early in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that the same people who decry a third-party progressive effort now will recognize historically that in the 19th century, they performed a terrific job in pushing one of the two major parties into extremely fundamental political and economic reforms, as I just mentioned earlier.
But do you think the time is ripe for that, or is it cementing in another 10 years, 20 years of GOP ascendancy?
More ripe than ever. By the way, the Democrats need more political candidates to teach them how to take on George W. Bush. I mean, I say this in all modesty, that if I was on a debate with George W. Bush compared to the Democratic candidates, I don't think there'd be anything left of him.
And what's the core reason for that, Ralph?
Because I'm not inhibited by dialing for dollars. Mm. I'm not saying, gee, I can't take him on the energy issue and oil and gas and all the corruption, all the taxpayer subsidies to this industry, because I'm raising money in Texas. I'm raising money in Montana. I'm raising money in California from these interests. That's why we got to go back to public funding of public campaigns across the board.
Mm. We're talking tonight with Ralph Nader, consumer advocate turned controversial political. You can join the conversation. Do you want to see another Ralph Nader candidacy for the presidency? Are the Republicans and Democrats essentially the same? Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Does the Bush administration, the Bush years, bear that out? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Ralph Nader, savior, spoiler, public citizen, preacher, and maybe presidential candidate again in the 2004 presidential elections. We've just got a few minutes left. Randall Kennedy, you've been waving your hand there. You've got a point to make responding to Ralph Nader.
Yeah. Mr. Nader spoke of the Democratic candidates as being indentured to the big corporations, and probably they are. But I'd like to posit an alternative. That is, perhaps one of the things that disciplines them is a voting public that is much more conservative than Mr. Nader suggests. I mean, he himself mentioned earlier in the hour that there were many, many laboring people, union people who voted for George Bush. We have a rather conservative country. What about that as a reason why the Democrats are simply don't speak with a more progressive rhetoric?
Ralph Nader?
Because the Republicans have defined the agenda around the social hot-button issues rather than the economic issues. For every statement by the Republican evangelicals on the social, so-called social issues, the Democrats should be raising the issues of corporations who have drained away or looted trillions of dollars from millions of workers, small investors, and their pension funds, laying off hundreds of thousands of workers in the last three-year corporate crime wave.
But maybe
Republicans
people
Republicans have not done anything about.
Well, yeah, but maybe people are more concerned about these hot-button social issues than the issues you're talking about.
They are when it's in a vacuum. But let me tell you, economic issues trump these social issues almost all the time, except the choice issue.
Then why isn't that playing out? Then why have Republicans been able to corral everything into the other side of the ledger?
Because the economic issues represent drawing a line between whether the Democrats are going to represent working families, as they were known under FDR and Truman, the party of the working families, or they're going to represent corporate interests that are funding their campaign.
So fundamentally, you feel certain that if that 100 million non-voting population was brought into the polls, they'd break down liberal, progressive, Democratic, Green Party, whatever you want to call it? Are you so sure?
Well, most of them are lower-income people. You tell me, if they see a party that's going to fight for them for have a livable wage, decent benefits, universal health care, a decent housing policy, consumer protection in the ghettos and elsewhere, against payday loans and rent-to-own rackets and all the rest to make their lives so miserable in a kind of debtor's prison, you tell me whether they're going to turn away from that party and vote for the party of the General Motors, Exxons, and Halliburtons.
Randall Kennedy, Ralph Nader makes it sound like a cakewalk if only the switch was turned
on. Well, yeah, but then you talk to people about things like gun control, things like the race issue, things like reproductive rights. And the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of people who don't vote in terms of their class interests. That's why there's never been a labor party, a socialist party in the United States. I think our politics are just more complicated than Mr. Nader's suggesting with these last comments.
Well, I'm saying they should be more complicated in terms of more issues. And the Democrats have been thrown on the defensive. You can always tell a party is failing when it's on the defense. The Democrats were on the offense in the 30s, in the 40s. They were on the offense in the 60s, even in the early 70s. When they pinned Nixon back so he was supporting universal health care and voting rights for the District of Columbia and so forth. But now they've been on the defense. And the one theme that explains that started over 20 years ago when Congressman Tony Coelho from California persuaded the congressional Democrats that they can raise as much money from business as the Republicans. And as Robert Reich, the former labor secretary and candidate for governor in Massachusetts, said in an article over a year and a half ago, the Democratic Party's dead, dead, dead. And he is about as Democrat as you can get. And that's his opinion, unless something wakes this party up.
Ralph Nader, our time is running right down, but we want to thank you for joining us tonight. Your energy is remarkable. You never give it up, and we thank you for joining the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Randall Kennedy, we've just got a few seconds left, but there's maybe a preacher, certainly a fighter, and maybe, again, a candidate.
It seems to me that we're going to have a candidate, and I think that the various tensions within the Democratic Party that we've been discussing will really loom as a major issue.
Randall Kennedy, thank you for joining us tonight. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a look at Tony Blair's historic address before the U.S. Congress. This is On Point. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair told a special joint session of Congress today that he believes, quote, with every fiber of instinct and conviction, that the war against Iraq was justified. But he warned that the work there is far from complete. We promised Iraq democratic government. We will deliver it, the Prime Minister said. Blair's address to Congress was the first by a British Prime Minister since Margaret Thatcher in 1985. It comes at a time when both Blair and President Bush are under growing criticism over pre-war intelligence and the handling of post-war reconstruction. Blair received a rousing reception from the U.S. Congress in marked contrast to the cold reception he's been getting at home, where his approval ratings are at an all-time low. Here is an excerpt from Tony Blair's speech.
The purpose of terrorism is not the single act of wanton destruction. It is the reaction it seeks to provoke. Economic collapse, the backlash, the hatred, the division, the elimination of tolerance, until society ceases to reconcile their differences and become defined by them. Kashmir, the Middle East, Chechnya, Indonesia, Africa. Barely a continent or nation is unscathed. The risk is that terrorism and states developing weapons of mass destruction come together. And when people say that risk is fanciful, I say we know the Taliban supported al-Qaeda. We know Iraq under Saddam gave haven to and supported terrorists. We know there are states in the Middle East now actively funding and helping people who regard it as God's will in the act of suicide to take as many innocent lives with them on their way to God's judgment. Some of these states are desperately trying to acquire nuclear weapons. We know that companies and individuals with expertise sell it to the highest bidder. And we know that at least one state, North Korea, lets its people starve while spending billions of dollars on developing nuclear weapons and exporting the technology abroad. This isn't fantasy. It is 21st century reality, and it confronts us now. Can we be sure that terrorism and weapons of mass destruction will join together? Let us say one thing. If we are wrong, we will have destroyed a threat that at its least is responsible for inhuman carnage and suffering. That is something I am confident history will forgive. But if our critics are wrong, if we are right, as I believe with every fiber of instinct and conviction I have that we are, and we do not act, then we will have hesitated in the face of this menace when we should have given leadership. That is something history will not forgive.
Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking before a special joint session of Congress earlier today. To consider the Prime Minister's speech, I'm joined this evening by Eleanor Clift, contributing editor at Newsweek magazine. Good evening and welcome back, Eleanor Clift.
Good evening.
And by Rob Watson, Washington correspondent for the BBC. Good evening, Rob Watson.
Good evening to you.
Eleanor Clift, to you first. Where did you see the main weight of Blair's speech falling in the U.S. Congress? What was the reception? What was he trying to get across to them and to the American public?
Well, I think the Prime Minister can articulate in a way that President Bush can't the reasons that the war in Iraq was fought and put it in a higher put it on a higher plane. I mean, I think he really got it out of all of the wrangling about the intelligence and reminded us of the reasons for going to war and the noble purpose. And I think he made everybody feel good about a situation that has really been deteriorating in recent days. I mean, you didn't hear any comments in the speech or the press conference that followed about the announcement by the new Iraqi commander that we are in a guerrilla war. You didn't hear Prime Minister Blair, with all his offers of help and the solidarity, that there are only 14,000 British soldiers left in Iraq, that this is really an American occupation now, and the difficulty the president is having getting help from around the world. For a brief moment here in the Congress, it all felt like it was a noble venture, it's all worth it, and I think everybody felt good about it for at least now.
So a feel-good moment in the rhetorical embrace of Tony Blair. But enough, Eleanor Clift, to push away the questions that have been raised in the last couple of weeks about intelligence, to ease concerns about the guerrilla war that the U.S. commander himself is raising?
Well, I think, again, Blair's eloquence can get us through what some on the Hill are calling the summer of our discontent. But it all depends on what happens on the ground in Iraq. If they can get the security situation under control, I think this will all be forgotten. And certainly if they find Saddam Hussein or weapons of mass destruction, the political dynamic will be turned around completely. If those things don't happen, I think that the president will continue to get the same battering that Prime Minister Blair is getting in Britain, where you have the media, you have government officials, and increasingly perhaps the public, you know, wondering whether this was worth it and worried about how long the engagement is going to be, how expensive it will be. And this is the first time the president has stepped out and really addressed the situation. Mm-hmm. For all of the deaths in recent weeks, he hasn't said much. And again, he cast it, we've got to be tough and we've got to stay in there, and it's morally the right thing to do. And I think the American people like that kind of language, but when you wake up every day and you hear another American has died in Iraq, if that continues throughout the summer, this is a serious political problem for this president.
Rob Watson, why is Tony Blair in Washington right now?
Well, he was in Washington because he was invited. That's the long and the short of it. He was invited for two reasons. Number one, to make this address to a joint session of Congress, which, of course, is massively flattering. He's only he's only the fourth Briton to have ever been accorded that honor. And he comes in some pretty distinguished company before him, Margaret Thatcher, Winston Churchill, and Clement Attlee. So no mean crowd there. He was also invited because he was supposed to be getting the Congressional Gold Medal. Again, an enormous compliment. So he was here, I think really it was originally intended as a thank you for Britain's support in the war against Iraq. Now, of course, the circumstances under which he has arrived are not perhaps exactly what he would have liked. I think that both the United States Congress, or certainly the Republicans and the Bush administration, and Mr. Blair would have preferred it if there hadn't been all this rather unpleasant aftertaste about the war of Iraq, both in terms of casualties in Iraq, but of course the questions being asked as to whether this war was justified in the first place.
Tony Blair's poll numbers in the UK are pretty dismal. Does this appearance before the US Congress joint session help him or not?
Well, you're absolutely right about the poll figures being pretty dismal. I think there was one poll that I saw that showed over 50% of British people thought that they wouldn't trust Tony Blair any further than they could throw him. As to whether this will help him, I don't know. I mean, what effect it will have to see how respected he is in the United States, you'll just have to wait until the polls come out. But I certainly think that within his own party, some of the extremely pro-American things that Tony Blair said about the United States' role in the world and how the UK, Britain would always be there to help, I think that's really going to rankle with some people in his own party and others in Britain who are not sure that the United States should be playing such a prominent role, and certainly not with Britain obediently alongside.
And Rob Watson, you know both sides of the Atlantic here. Eleanor Clift mentioned how persuasive Tony Blair sounds standing in the U.S. Congress. Is he more persuasive in the United States than he is in his home country these days? And if so, I wonder why.
Well, he is much more so. I guess it's partly because he's not running for office here. But he is a man of great eloquence. And I think that there is an interesting thing, and it may explain why he's more popular in the United States. I think, having lived in the United States a long time, but having also lived in the UK a long time and studied British political history, there's something rather different about Tony Blair. In some ways, he sounds so much more American. He's a man who talks about moral issues, a man who talks about good and evil, a man who's clearly a religious man, a man who sees a mission in the world. Now, characteristically, British politicians haven't done that, not even Margaret Thatcher. Sure, she didn't like communism very much, but she tended to be rather pragmatic. She tended to be very much to talk in terms of what Britain's national interest was. Well, Tony Blair doesn't do that. He often talks about good and evil, Britain's place in the world, and these missions, even this speech to Congress.
So an American blush on a British prime minister.
Exactly.
Rob Watson, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. And Eleanor Clift, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Eleanor Clift is contributing editor for Newsweek magazine in Washington. Rob Watson is the BBC's Washington correspondent. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Julie Diop, and tonight from Dub Shugarts. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.